Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Representatives from 20 countries around the world are in New York today, gathered there for a third round of talks on a proposed Syrian political transition, weeks before a plan to launch UN-mediated talks between the Syrian government and opposition. The so-called Syrian International Syria Support Group also hopes to submit a resolution to be endorsed by the UN Security Council. The resolution would support the plan for a political transition and a proposed ceasefire. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is chairing today's U.N. meeting. Meantime, the U.N. Security Council has turned up the heat on the self-proclaimed Islamic State, strengthening international measures to cut the flow of cash to the group's war chest. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the U.N.
The U.N. Security Council has turned its attention to the group's biggest vulnerability, its bank account, ratcheting up efforts to weaken the terrorists by keeping cash out of their hands. The Council is hoping its action will cut off the group's ability to use the international financial system to move money and pay for supplies and fighters. It also will help with the imposition of targeted sanctions and oblige states to report on what they are doing to combat terrorist financing. In its efforts to combat terrorism, the international community aims to make sure there is no safe haven for terrorist financing. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Rwandans are at the polls today voting on a referendum to allow President Paul Kagame to run for as many as three more terms in office. The ballot question asks for approval of an amendment to shorten presidential terms from 7 years to five, and it would make an exception for Kagame, allowing him to run for a third 7-year term, as well as two more 5-year terms after that. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter made a surprise visit to Afghanistan today, meeting with U.S. military commanders and Afghan officials. This visit comes as a new Afghan political group is pressuring the Kabul government to do more to stabilize the strife-torn country. Carter arrived amid an intensified Taliban insurgency and new concerns over Islamic State loyalists whose emergence has complicated U.S.-led efforts to stabilize Afghanistan. The secretary traveled to Jalalabad, the capital of eastern Nangarhar province, where several hundred U.S. soldiers are stationed, to express American gratitude to service personnel.
I'm here partly to wish our service members a happy holiday, because it's obviously holiday time for us, and remembering that they're here and not at home, but that they're here doing a noble thing, which is working with our Afghan partners and the rest of our coalition partners to help Afghanistan protect it and build itself, and at the same time be an enduring friend.
The U.S. base in Jalalabad, called Operating Base Fenty, is engaged in training, logistics, and counterterrorism activities. Pro-IS extremists have conducted attacks against local security forces in the province and are said to have seized control of a few remote districts. The International Organization for Migration says the number of refugees and migrants arriving in Europe by sea and land this year is expected to top the 1 million mark next week. The Geneva-based agency, in a statement today marked as International Migrants Day, said that 990,761 people have arrived from Africa or the Middle East. About 800,000 crossed from Turkey to Greece, and among them, more than half, 455,000, are Syrian. IOM spokesman Joel Millen said that 4,300 people arrived from the Turkish coast to Greek islands Wednesday, and the organization estimates the 1 million mark will be reached by next Tuesday.
IOM estimates that the million-person mark will pass. This is almost five times last year's level, which is extraordinary. We also want to point out that these very high flows for December are proving to be what we feared, very lethal, particularly in the eastern Mediterranean, where we counted 706 deaths so far this year. That's 422 since October 16th, so 2 months ago, an average of 7 a day.
The IOM said daily arrivals continue in the thousands despite the colder temperatures and dangerous ocean seas. A Dutch appeals court has ruled a group of Nigerian farmers can sue an international oil company, Royal Dutch, for pollution. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency warns the number of people forcibly displaced from their homes is likely to exceed 60 million in 2015. The UNHCR has released its mid-year trends 2015 report, covering global forced displacement during the first 6 months of this year.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Rwandans go to the polls today to vote on a referendum that would change the Constitution and allow President Paul Kagame to run for as many as three more terms in office. The U.S. gives another $88 million in humanitarian aid to Ethiopia to battle a severe health crisis that's looming in the country. And a Dutch appeals court rules that a group of Nigerian farmers can sue the international oil company Royal Dutch Shell for pollution. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Rwandans went to the polls today to vote on a referendum that would change the Constitution and allow President Paul Kagame to run for as many as three more terms in office. Today's referendum seeks approval of an amendment that would shorten presidential terms to 5 years rather than seven. However, the amendment would make an exception for Mr. Kagame. It would allow him to run for a third seven-year term and two more five-year terms after that. President Kagame said the referendum is the will of the people and they will decide. He added that if the referendum passes, he will make a decision on whether to seek a third term, as he put it, when the time comes. Current law requires him to step down at the end of 2017. If the referendum passes as expected and he continues to win elections, he could stay in power until 2034. A Washington-based think tank warns that South Sudan is facing the possibility of renewed conflict. The International Crisis Group says there are at least 24 armed groups throughout the country, and it says that number is expected to rise. E.J. Hagendorn, the Africa Deputy Program Director for the ICG, tells reporter Ayen Bior that the rise of armed groups and the lack of implementation of the August peace deal could lead the country to even more violence.
Well, unfortunately, what we're seeing is the splintering of the SPLA in opposition, in addition to the emergence of a number of insurgencies in other parts of South Sudan. And if that is allowed to continue, it will mean there will be a very chaotic war with many different parties that will be very difficult to control or to end.
And the International Crisis Group believes that a more assertive JMAC led by Festus Mahai is key to fully implementing the peace agreement. And many in the diplomatic community are echoing this sentiment, including Ambassador Princeton Lyman, who was, of course, the former U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. Could you speak a little more about the potential of influence that JMEC could have in preventing fresh violence in South Sudan?
Well, the JMEC will be essentially the representative of the international community in Juba and vis-a-vis the parties that signed the peace agreement. Unfortunately, the peace agreement is far from ideal. There is going to be a lot of halting progress in getting the different parties to adhere to the peace deal. And thus, we need someone in Juba pushing the parties consistently to do the things that they've agreed to.
The arrival of Riek Machar and the SPLM-IO has been pushed back several times just in the last couple of weeks due to some disagreements with the government, as well as other factors. Do you think there will be any lasting consequences on the back and forth between the government and the IO on agreeing to their return?
Well, of course, the delays in getting the SPLM in opposition to return to Juba is one of the reasons we felt it was necessary to release our statement about the risks of a renewed war. That said, we always felt that implementation of the peace agreement would be halting and there would be many challenges. And thus, it is our position that were the Esperanto to go to Juba, things could be salvaged. Unfortunately, if they aren't pushed to do that, it could really undermine any willingness to implement the peace agreement in full.
That was E.J. Hagendorn of the International Crisis Group speaking to South Sudan and Focus reporter Ayen Bior from Washington. The African Union has approved a proposal to send 5,000 peacekeepers to control political unrest and daily violence in Burundi. Reuters says the authorization was voted on last night and requires the approval of the UN Security Council. UN officials and Western donors remain alarmed at the escalating violence in Burundi, a country that earlier suffered 12 years of ethnic warfare. The UN says at least 400 people have been killed since April. The current protest and violence erupted after President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for and won a controversial third-term office. The unrest is centered in the capital, Bujumbura, where insurgents attacked military bases on Friday. About 90 people died in the clashes. A diplomat representing one of the members of the Security Council has told Reuters that the AU proposal has already been approved. Mr. Nkurunziza says his country needs no help from outsiders. The United States has given another $88 million in humanitarian aid to Ethiopia. The aid is being sent to battle a severe health crisis that's looming in the drought-stricken country. The drought is the result of weather patterns created by the El Nino phenomenon. The U.S. aid package increases funding for nutrition, water, food, sanitation, and hygiene. The additional aid brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance for Ethiopia to more than $435 million this year. The government of Ethiopia estimates that more than 10 million people will need food assistance within the next few months. Another 8 million Ethiopians who are already chronically food insecure are being served through Ethiopia's safety net program. The UN Refugee Agency warns the number of people forcibly displaced from their homes is likely to exceed 60 million in 2015. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva. The UNHCR has released its mid-year trends 2015 report, covering global forced displacement during the first 6 months of this year.
The UNHCR report does not include the hundreds of thousands of refugees who made the perilous journey to Europe across the Mediterranean, nor the thousands more seeking refuge from many conflicts around the world during the last half of this year. But the report says the numbers are staggering and alarming. Figures show the global refugee total by mid-2015 had exceeded 20 million, the highest number since 1992. Asylum claims had gone up by 78% from last year, and the numbers of internally displaced people had jumped by around 2 million to an estimated 34 million. UN refugee spokesman Adrian Edwards tells VOA the current levels of forcible displacement, predicted to reach more than 60 million by year's end, have not been seen since World War II.
Today, each of us has a 1 in 122 chance of becoming a refugee, becoming displaced. And that's very worrying, because what happens to people once they become refugees, today they're staying refugees often for very many years, some for their lifetimes.
Edward says huge numbers of Syrians have fled war and persecution during the past 5 years. He says Syrians account for nearly one quarter of the world's 20 million refugees, and millions more are displaced within the country.
And I would point to the fact that both in Syria, where you have more than 6 million people internally displaced, but also in many other countries where we're seeing rising internal displacement, this is a big, big worry, because internal displacement is often an early warning indicator of future refugee flows.
The report says voluntary return rates are at their lowest levels in three decades. The UNHCR says there is little political will on the part of governments to work together to find solutions to the growing refugee and displacement problems. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Five days after a referendum in the Central African Republic on a new constitution, the vote count is in for the capital, Bangui. The National Election Authority says 90% of the voters in the city approved the proposed constitution. Reuters news agency reports an election official calls the vote in the capital a provisional count. He says the results of voting in the rest of the country will be completed in the next 3 days. Approval of the referendum would pave the way for December 24th national elections of a president and a parliament. The proposed constitution reduces presidential powers and creates a Senate to work alongside the existing National Assembly. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Rwandans go to the polls to vote on a referendum that would change the constitution and allow President Paul Kagame to run for as many as three more terms in office. The U.S. gives another $88 million in humanitarian aid to Ethiopia to battle a severe health crisis that's looming in the country. And the U.N. Refugee Agency warns the number of people forcibly displaced from their homes is likely to exceed 60 million in 2015. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. A Dutch appeals court has ruled that a group of Nigerian farmers can sue the international oil company Royal Dutch Shell for pollution. The farmers say oil was leaking from Shell subsidiary pipelines. The court in The Hague handed down its ruling today. The ruling was the first of its kind, meaning it could set a precedent for other Dutch-based companies being sued for the alleged negligence of their subsidiaries elsewhere. Four Nigerian farmers, backed by the Dutch branch of the environmental group Friends of the Earth, say Shell should clean up oil spills in four villages in Nigeria's oil country, the Niger Delta. They also want Shell to pay compensation to the villagers and prevent further spills. The plaintiffs first filed their lawsuit in 2008. A lower court in the Netherlands threw out most of the suit in 2013, saying the plaintiffs could not hold the parent company responsible for the spills. It held the subsidiary responsible in one claim, but not in the other three. But the appeals court today ruled in favor of the Nigerians in all four cases. It also ordered Shell to make available the internal documents the plaintiffs could use to support their case. Refugees from Ivory Coast will once again start returning home this week from UN camps in Liberia. They had sought refuge there during the 2010-2011 conflict. The UN Refugee Agency stopped repatriation efforts last year because of the Ebola epidemic. Emily Yob reports from Abidjan that for many, coming home means starting over from scratch.
In her little shared courtyard in Abidjan, former refugee Nadege Blé reflects on her new life. I don't regret to have returned, she says. It's my home country. We're better here. But they need to help us. Blé, a photographer by trade, is struggling to rebuild her business. She came home in 2013 after a year and a half in a refugee camp in Togo. She says the government promised them assistance and jobs. So she says, I came home but I didn't get any of this help. I had to fight to have school fees taken care of for my children and I only got it last year. With the help of the UNHCR, Blé submitted a microfinance proposal to restart her photography business this year. She's waiting for approval. In all, 300,000 people fled Ivory Coast during the post-election violence that swept the country in 2010 and 2011. Since then, 80% have returned, said Nora Sturm, a communication officer at the UNHCR. She says Blaise's case is not unique.
These refugees have been out of the country for years, and they come back and they often have lost their homes, their jobs, their lands.
Stern said the UNHCR is trying to help them reintegrate, but with about 240,000 returnees in the past 4 years, the need is great.
When they return to Cote d'Ivoire, they're hoping that their lives will be as good as they were when they left, or even better. And we do provide them with sort of startup financial assistance to get their lives back on track, but our resources are quite limited.
It wasn't an easy transition for Moussa Diomande. The 40-year-old state representative remembers the day his convoy of returnees from Togo reached Abidjan. I asked myself, is it really Abidjan, he says. At the camp, they will tell that everything has been destroyed. I was wondering why I had stayed away for so long while people had already come back and were already building their lives. Diomande used the startup money the UNHCR gave him to rent a place to live with other former refugees. We didn't know where to start, he says. We had nothing left. Little by little, Diomande reactivated his client network and business started to take off. Now he has created his own company and lives in a newly built apartment in a new neighborhood in Abidjan. Here is his advice to the people returning now.
Je leur dirais d'être fort mentalement.
I will tell them to be strong mentally, he says. They can do even better than the one who stayed here, but shouldn't think that everything will fall on their lap. The government might give a little help, but ultimately, it will be up to them to make it work. The UN Refugee Agency says 11,000 Ivorian refugees in Liberia have already signed up for this new round of voluntary returns. Amy Diop for VOA News in Abidjan.
An international agriculture organization calls on climate leaders to put women and youth at the forefront of action plans to address climate issues. The CGIAR Research Program on Climate Change, Agriculture and Food Security says just mentioning women and youth in the preamble to the recent climate agreement draft is not enough. They urge the challenges women face due to climate change should be woven in throughout the text of the agreement, and specific efforts should be made to ensure linkages to food security and agriculture. Sophia Heyer is the Gender and Social Inclusion Research Leader for the CGIAR Research Program. She spoke with me about the important roles women play in climate issues and why they are a key component for food security.
Globally, women are heavily involved in agriculture at about 43% to 48%, according to the FAO. But in the developing world, their participation can be as much as 70%, 80%, 90%. Across the least developed countries, 79% of women cite agriculture as their primary economic activity. So that's the first thing. Women are crucially important in the developing world in agriculture, and they play all sorts of roles, you know, from planting to seeding to harvesting to marketing and to selling produce, you know, in the local market. Their production does tend to be for home use as well, so vegetable gardening around the homestead, but they also engage in other sorts of agriculture. So that's a huge issue right there. And what we found is that technical support, the advice, the extension, the resources, the credit, the training, all of that tends to go to men. Women's participation in extension programs and farmer schools, for example, is quite low. And in fact, there is such a large gender gap in agriculture in all of these areas that the FAO has said that if women farmers were to have equal access to these resources with men, so this would be resources of information, credit, services, extension, and training, as well as technology, in my view. I'm not sure if they actually say technology, but basically inputs for production. If this were as equal between women and men farmers, then the global production would increase by 2.54%, and the number of the hungry people in the world would decrease by 12 to 14%, or about 100 to 150 million. And as we know, climate change is going to be bring increasing stresses on agriculture and food security.
Do you think during the negotiation process that this was addressed to the limit that it should have been regarding gender and youth issues?
Not at all. You know, in general, gender and youth are brought into the preamble, basically, acknowledging the rights, development as well as gender equality, empowerment of women, and intergenerational equity. That's the only reference to youth that I can find. You may have found another one. But I can only find two mentions to gender equality and two mentions to intergenerational equity. And those are very, very general as kind of pre-discussions to the rest of the agreement. In terms of gender and agriculture, we did a review of the INDCs. CCAF went through about 160 of the INDCs a few weeks before COP21, and we found that only 10 countries have referred to women in agriculture. So while there are more references to women in general and gender equality, not quite enough in my view, but more, there are only 10 recognizing the role of women as farmers. So that's a big gap.
So what needs to be done to make sure that there are gender-responsive climate policies and programs looking forward?
There needs to be the recognition of the roles that women play in agriculture and in other sectors that are being affected by climate change, in energy, in water management, in natural resource management. Most of the references to women and gender in the INDCs refer to women as vulnerable populations and the impacts on them, which is true. Women often are in the vulnerable populations, but so are men. And so it's not sufficient to say that women are in the vulnerable category. There needs to be much more recognition of the role that women play in all of these sectors, the importance of their contributions, and strategies to support them. So there needs to be a push for capacity development of women farmers. There needs to be a push for ensuring that they have the information and the services and the technologies they need. There needs to be recognition that they are active producers of food and active stakeholders in food security. And I do not see that in the INDCs or in the final document.
Do you think world leaders, just as you all point out, that women and youth, they are the future of tomorrow regarding food security? So
yes,
then do you think the international community is understanding that?
No, they aren't, and they should. They need to immediately, because, of course, in addition to the numbers I gave you, the percentages and proportion of women and youth as farmers in the developing world is increasing as a result of male out-migration to urban centers for employment. And so what you're seeing is that women and the older population are staying in the rural areas, and they become responsible for agriculture and food production, both for the family and for the village and for the country. So this is a really important, urgent issue that needs to be addressed immediately. You know, with the impacts of climate change are being felt in agriculture already. And if we don't want to have more migrants as a result of famines or economic problems, then we need to help the farmers in the developing world.
That was Sophia Heyer, Gender and Social Inclusion Research Leader for the CGIAR Research Program on Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security. She spoke with me from Brighton, Ontario. This is Africa News Tonight. It's coming up on 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
The flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
Next on Let's Talk, romance. Is it important in sustaining a relationship? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing romance. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Rwandans go to the polls today to vote on a referendum that would change the constitution and allow President Paul Kagame to run for as many as three more terms in office. The U.S. gives another $88 million in humanitarian aid to Ethiopia to battle a severe health crisis that's looming in the country. And the U.N. Refugee Agency warns the number of people forcibly displaced from their homes is likely to exceed 60 million in 2015. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy, happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy, happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning with boxing again.
Kim, our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta, has been taking a look at some of the boxing highlights and lowlights of 2015. And Nnamdi joins us again on the Sunny Side of Sports. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Nnamdi, let's go to Russia now, where a former world champion, great boxer in his prime, Roy Jones Jr., gets into the ring at the age of 46. And this was not good, Nnamdi. What happened? How about some details?
Sonny, wasn't pretty. It wasn't pretty. For a Hall of Famer to get knocked out cold, Sonny. This is from a guy, Enzo Macarinelli from the UK, a guy that could barely fight. Big, massive right hand, uppercut. You see Roy Jones tumbling all over the canvas with jello legs, man. It was really scary. You wonder why is he still fighting at the age of 46.
Well, why is he still fighting, Nnamdi? Doesn't he make decent money as a boxing commentator?
As a HBO boxing commentator, Sonny, this card pulls in more than $200,000 a year. He didn't really blow all the money he made. Why is he fighting? Has to do with his ego. And everybody's begging him now to stop, to stop. He won't stop. He's like an African politician. They don't know when to leave.
Now, what about this dual citizenship, Nnamdi? I know
it's
he
went, right.
Is it just a farce or what?
He's a smart businessman. He's a good friend of Putin, you know. And Putin's sitting there watching him get knocked out cold. I mean, he might want to take back the citizenship, you know.
I got to believe the way that fight ended, though, Nnamdi. Roy must be thinking there's got to be a better way to make a few bucks.
No, he won't quit. Sonny, he won't quit. You know, okay, he puts down those fights in Russia because in America here, nobody will go see this fight. It means nothing. That's why he got the Russian citizenship. He gets all the tax breaks, you know. He's a promoter. He handpicks these guys. But suddenly, a dead man from the grave just banks you out. And that was it. Not only knocking you out cold, you know. So nobody expected this to happen. But this is fight. This is the fight game. That's why it's called the sweet science. This thing happened. This is not wrestling. You can get killed in the ring.
Nnamdi, one of the most eagerly awaited fights of 2015, Manny Pacquiao, the Filipino star against Floyd Mayweather from the United States, a letdown in many respects. Mayweather won a unanimous decision. Looking back on that fight in May, Nnamdi, what did you think?
It was a bad fight for the game, you know, and the fight destroyed the pay-per-view. That fight brought in more than $500 million, Sonny, and everybody went to the bank, but the fans really got ripped off. It's going to take a long time for the fans to come back to putting up money for pay-per-view fight. And now Manny Pacquiao is still sitting around waiting for Money Mayweather to give him a rematch. We don't know.
Floyd Mayweather, 49-0 with that victory over Pac-Man Nnamdi. Will he fight again in 2016 and get that 50th victory?
He's a smart businessman. He knows. He's waiting on us. You know, he knows we're gonna miss him. You know, he knows we're gonna demand for him to come back because the 49 and 0 doesn't really make it. 50 and 0 will make it, and everybody will pay to see the rematch. So it's just making everybody wait, going around the globe, enjoying his money. People will then demand, say, we want to see a rematch with Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather. And then Floyd will come out and say, yes, you asked for it. I will do it now.
Nnamdi, I remember in one of our recent boxing chats, you said a next Mayweather fight could be linked with the opening of a new casino in Vegas. Any updates on that?
Well, this is a brand new MGM Grand Arena at the casino. And this is due to open in May. On the other hand, Manny Pacquiao is a politician. The election season is coming up in the Philippines. We don't know what's going to happen, but we still feel there's a good chance this fight will happen with Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao for the number two, and it will be at the MGM, at the new arena.
Another big fight in 2015, Nnamdi. Canelo, Saul Alvarez from Mexico against Miguel Cotto from Puerto Rico. Canelo won that fight. Let's look back on that bout, Nnamdi. What were the pay-per-view numbers?
Well, Sonny, the projection was for 1.5 million baht. The final numbers came in. It was 900,000, with a total of $57 million just for pay-per-view alone. When you add the closed circuits, foreign TV rights, live gates, you're looking at a fight that will have that will total on the table 80 million plus. Good numbers, though. I mean, but yeah, and I think Canelo now is the grand poobah of boxing.
Canelo, the grand poobah. What is next for him in 2016, Nnamdi?
Well, they just made this deal with the WBC and the promoters. They're not going into the fight with Triple G, Gennady Golovkin, right away. There will be an interim bout, which Canelo will have in May. And Triple G will head to Monaco for his interim bout and then come back for the huge build-up in the fall of 2016 after the Olympics for the big, big mega fight.
Where would that big, big mega fight be held, Nnamdi? Vegas?
Well, they're talking about Las Vegas, which is a casino that will guarantee the money. They're talking about the Dallas Cowboys Stadium in Dallas. And they're talking about Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. When you look at Dallas Cowboys Stadium, you're looking at 100,000 plus. LA, you're looking at the Coliseum, you're looking at 100,000 plus. At the casino, well, you know, the whole city will make money. So it looks like more like the casino, because then the casino and all the other casinos will make good money. So, and the tax break in Nevada is much better than Texas and California.
I know it's early, Nnamdi. Looking at Canelo Triple G, how do you see that fight going?
I'm a big fan of both guys, and both guys can fight. And I believe Canelo is younger. The question becomes, will Canelo make Triple G come down to 155 pounds, which is the catch weight, which is not the 160 pounds for the middleweight fight? If Canelo is able to bring Triple G to come down to 155, I think Canelo will have the edge. Young, strong, is a power puncher, and I think Canelo can knock out Triple G. Triple G is okay, but it's all hype. It's for the whole bunch of dead guys.
Nnamdi, are there any other big fights that we can look forward to in 2016?
Right now, we look at what will bring eyeballs. We look at who will pull the gates. This fight, Canelo, Triple G, and of course Tyson Fury with my homeboy, Anthony Joshua, and maybe David Haye coming back. The heavyweight division is the engine right now. The heavyweight division is where the action is, and the middleweight division. So these are the fights we're looking at. Any other fights, they are okay there, but they are not on the level of pay-per-view or global fights.
Thanks, Nnamdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta.
Galala! Great show, bro.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. As I reported on Thursday's show, veteran American soccer star Abby Wambach made her 255th and final international appearance for the world champion USA this week. Abby's fond farewell was spoiled a bit, though, by a 1-0 loss to China in a friendly match played in the southern U.S. city of New Orleans, Louisiana. At the post-match press conference, the 35-year-old Wambach had this to say.
I love my teammates for wanting to give me the send-off that we all kind of quote-unquote envisioned, but I think it's kind of symbolic, right? I get 70 minutes, and we don't score a goal. For me, it's like, okay, it's time to step away. The symbolism in it for me is amazing, and I know everybody is going to be like, oh, gosh. Everybody in the locker room, like, they're just like, I'm so sorry, you know? And I'm like, there's nothing to be sorry about. You know, today wasn't about getting a result. It was about celebrating not just my career, but the chances that I've had with all my other teammates and the time that I've spent with them. And I think everything kind of just hit me that, you know, this was the last time I'd be taking the jersey off. You know, this is the last time I'd be hanging out with my teammates in the locker room. And they're all happy tears. You know, I'm not questioning whether I should retire or not. I know that my career has come full circle. I feel very complete about it. And the future of this team is so bright.
Abby Wambach steps away from the world champion U.S. Women's National Soccer Team as world football's all-time leading scorer, male or female, with 184 goals. Follow The Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. Let me give a Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Antoine Kamwenyi, who wished me a happy Friday on Facebook. And Antoine says he listens to The Sunny Side of Sports in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo. I took a peek at Antoine's Facebook page, and I can tell you he's a student in the Congolese capital. Thanks for listening, Antoine. Austin Njoku sent me another Facebook message from Abuja, Nigeria. Austin says, it's good to hear Nnamdi Moeta, our reigning prince of pugilistics, on the program again this week. Austin says he always enjoys Nnamdi's verbal jabs. Fidelis Olorunmo also writes from Abuja. Fidelis says he listens to The Sunny Side of Sports on Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, and he always enjoys the sporty analysis and banter. On that note, it was great to see Dr. Larry Zamaje and my friends at Brilla FM in Lagos in October. In addition to Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has Brilla FM stations in Kaduna and Onitsha in Nigeria. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's The Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Well, coming up, we highlight the challenges and rewards of an African immigrant who washes windows for a living in New York City. And a new biography of Michael Jackson looks into the life of the child star and troubled man he grew up to be. First, here's Lady Felicia of Sierra Leone with African Music.
Africa.
Lady Felicia, who loves African music. Well, of the hundreds of thousands of Africans who immigrated to the U.S. over the last 10 years, the highest number came to New York. Each of these newcomers has a personal story of why they came and the challenges and rewards they faced when they got there. In this profile, we meet Ibrima Kamara of The Gambia, an entrepreneur who washes windows for small businesses in the city. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Kamara Ibrima of The Gambia adjusts his traditional Muslim cap, called a kufi, and then soaps up the 3-meter-high window of a neighborhood tavern. He deftly maneuvers his squeegee wiper down the glass panes in one serpentine motion, leaving them sparkling. Most people take training classes or apprenticeships for this skill, but not Ibrima.
Absolutely not. I don't learn it from anybody, and nobody's telling me is this is the way you have to do. A friend of mine told me about the window cleaning, so I go get the tools on Home Depot, and I bought the buckets, soaps, poles, and I go in the city. When I take my tools to enter the city of New York, it's like, how am I getting customers? I don't know nobody, and nobody know me. Some people say yes, some people say, oh no, we got a window cleaner, we got a guy to do it. So I just think about it, hey, God is my provider.
In a leap of faith, Ibrima printed up some business cards. He left them with managers at grocery stores, auto parts outlets, African hair braiding salons, anywhere friendly with dirty windows. Finally, a janitor at a small hospital gave him the answer he wanted.
The guy called me, he said, okay, so you want to clean our windows? You got it. Go ahead. So I just come on and do it. It's a honest work, and once you do it, the clients are happy with you. But now, thank God, I have a lot of customers. It's been a while, like almost 6 years now. Then I give credit to God because I can't do anything by myself except God help.
Ibrima got his spiritual values from his father and 12 brothers back in Basu, The Gambia. He says his family has been devoutly Muslim for generations, and he was raised to treat everyone with honesty and respect and to keep an open mind. His father continues to fish and farm today, and though one of his wives has died, he still lives happily with two others.
They're all old now. My father was like over 90 years or almost 90 years.
It's funny because I have one wife, and I think that's plenty. That's enough.
So our cultures is different. Over there, it depends if you have a capacity to provide them.
You have to take care of
everybody. You have to take care of them. It's not like here, oh, women work, men work, we're all going to help each other. No. Us, men, are the responsibility. The women stay home and take care of the kids and take care of the house. And that's how we are.
Ibrima is unsure of his age. He thinks he's 45. He has yearned to start his own family since he was young. Still, he knew his share of the family inheritance would not be enough to support a family properly. So in 2000, he said goodbye to the family home on the banks of the peaceful river he and his brother shared with hippopotamuses and not a few crocodiles, and went to work, first in Benin, then 3 years later in New York. He says he had a good life back home.
When I moved from my country, I just looked to have money to build my foundation, which was my future kids. In my country, I can eat 3 times a day. But as we all know, if you don't have money, so you look like nothing. So that's how we Africans move from Africa to come here and build your future to be something tomorrow.
But keeping to his religious faith in mostly secular New York has sometimes been a challenge.
United States is the best country. I can pick it number one in the entire world. If you are in United States here, nobody against your religion. Whatever you want to be here, you can be. But here is too much freedom, too much women. But God has supported me for 12 years. I never have any girlfriend. Sometimes if you walk on the street, you might see different things, but you just have to control yourself.
Ibrima prayed hard for a wife. Recently, he met and fell in love with a devout young woman, also from The Gambia. Together, they dream of the day they can have a proper traditional ceremony back in The Gambia.
Family came, so brothers and friends came, you cook food, and then we sit on the living room, talking, chatting, happy, laughing. You know, after that, you take some food and send it to the Muslim brothers to eat. and make prayer for you to have a blessed marriage with your new wife. I'm looking forward to that.
Like many immigrants in America, Abrima let his tourist visa expire, intending to stay on to work without documents. But unlike many immigrants, he has no desire to become an American citizen someday.
America is sweet. It's a great country. It's a great city. But it's never going to be compared with my homeland. I love my homeland because that's the way I born. That's the way I grow. That's the culture I understand. I know when I was there who I am.
With that, Kamara Abrima straps his window washing bucket, brushes, wiper, and poles back on his bicycle. And in a flash, he's off to the next job, and ultimately to his long yearned for a new life back home in the Gambia. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
In a career spanning four decades, Michael Jackson became a global icon. He sold more than 400 million albums, earned 13 Grammy Awards, and spun dance moves that captivated the world. 6 years after his death, the legacy of the King of Pop is still being explored. MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson, is the latest book to look into the life of the child star and troubled man. Author Steve Knopper says despite years of scandal and controversy, Jackson's legacy will be his music. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Steve Knopper spent 3 years interviewing more than 400 people who knew Michael Jackson, relatives, friends, record executives, and celebrities.
He was a genius on many levels, but the three key ones to me were his intuitive singing style, the way he put in those rhythms, and secondly, the way he innovated dance at a time when really there wasn't a lot of dance in pop culture. And then thirdly, his songwriting. I think he doesn't get enough credit for being a great songwriter.
Michael Jackson's rise to superstardom really began in the late 1970s when he started collaborating with legendary record producer Quincy Jones.
It really was Quincy bringing a whole team to the studio, and sometimes they would work on Michael's songs together, and other times he would bring in a prominent songwriter, Rod Temperton, who wrote Thriller and a lot of other great Michael songs.
And it was Thriller, released in 1982, that propelled Jackson across pop music's racial barriers.
It's close to midnight. Something evil's lurking in the dark.
Disco, which had been huge for 3 or 4 years, had just crashed. And so when Michael came along with Thriller, radio stations and MTV and other entities within the music business were segregated, so it was black artists were on urban, quote-unquote urban radio stations, and white artists were on either rock or top 40 or other kinds of radio stations. And so Quincy and Michael and their team, specifically decided that they wanted to make music that was for everybody.
Collaborating with white musicians was another way to break the racial barriers in music. Jackson did that with former Beatle Paul McCartney on The Girl Is Mine, and 4 months later with heavy metal hero Eddie Van Halen.
The doggone girl is mine.
It was the way for Michael to, as an African-American artist, to kind of get onto white pop stations, if you will, using Paul McCartney.
Because the doggone girl is mine.
And once he was able to make that move, all the rest of the songs followed. Later, of course, to get on white rock stations, they employed Eddie Van Halen.
One of Jackson's trademarks was his moonwalk dance, the famous glide that looks like he's moving forward and backward at the same time.
Michael learned that dance from a number of different sources, including himself, but specifically from a group of dancers. Their names were Casper Candidate and Cooley Jackson, and there was another guy named Jeffrey Daniel. He eventually invited a couple of these guys to come teach it to him directly. And I did an interview with Cooley, Cooley Jackson, who kind of explained how Michael kept saying, I'm not getting it, I'm not getting it. It's a very difficult move to get, and it doesn't click until you work on it and work on it and work on it. And finally, it clicked, and Michael got it.
Jackson also showed that persistence in making sure the words and music clicked. Some of his best songs were years in the making, like Earth Song from the 1995 History album.
What about sunrise? What about rain? What about all the things that you said we were to gain?
Michael was a great balladeer, but Earth Song was one of his best and most complex ballads, and he used it in different ways. You know, he used it to sort of talk about saving the environment, to talk about saving the children, and it was a very adaptable anthem, and he really labored over this anthem and kept tinkering with it and tinkering with it over a period of 7 or 8 years, and finally he turned it into this big, bold anthem.
Author Steve Knopper says Michael Jackson's impact on pop music hasn't faded, even in death, and his legacy will fuel the music industry for generations to come. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
Saif al-Adel is a fugitive and suspected high-ranking member of the Al-Qaeda terror network who was wanted in connection with the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya. He is an Egyptian citizen with black hair and dark eyes. He is also believed to be affiliated with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. He is also known as Ibrahim al-Madani and Muhammad Ibrahim Makawi. Hundreds of people were killed in the embassy attacks and thousands wounded, most Kenyan and Tanzanian citizens. 12 Americans died. For these and other acts, al-Adel is charged with murder, conspiracy to destroy United States property, and other crimes. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Adel's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there.
Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.